10:06.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Political upheavals in Baghdad and the ongoing threat of Islamic militants raises serious concerns about the stability of Iraq. President Obama ordered airstrikes against the militant group known as ISIS that threatens Yazidis trapped on a mountaintop in Kurdistan, as well as U.S. personnel in Erbil. The U.S. is also airdropping relief packages to the refugees who are in dire straits. The CIA is reportedly arming Kurdish military forces to take on ISIS, which controls sizable parts of Iraq and Syria. 130 U.S. military advisors arrived in northern Iraq yesterday. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, Iraqi lawmakers chose a new president who chose a new prime minister, replacing Nouri al-Maliki. He's been blamed for creating many of the problems facing Iraq today and is reluctant to give up power. Will he go quietly? We have two guests who have joined us to answer many of the questions raised by what is going on in Iraq today. Let me introduce them to you. Barak Mendelson is Associate Professor of Political Science at Haverford College, a Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, author of Combating Jihadism, American Hegemony, and International Cooperation in the War on Terrorism. Barak Mendelson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Brendan O'Leary. He's the Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, Director of the Penn Program on Ethnic Conflict. He has been an advisor to the Kurdistan Regional Government in Iraq, author of several books, including How to Get Out of Iraq with Integrity. Joining us from Galway, Ireland. And Brendan O'Leary, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning to both of you. And Brendan O'Leary, if I can begin with you, and even looking at the title of your book, How to Get Out of Iraq with Integrity, is the United States being dragged or drawn back into Iraq? Do we have him? No, we don't seem to have him. Let me put that question to you, Barak Mendelson.
Yes, the U.S. is being dragged into Iraq.
There's a whole range of voices cutting across me from within the studio.
Okay, he's hearing a lot of voices in the studio. We will fix that for you, Brendan O'Leary. So, Barak Mendelson, I apologize for this kind of messy start of the show today. I'll put the question to you again, Barak Mendelson. I mean, do you see the United States being drawn back into Iraq, or is the United States being sort of careful and very strategic by sending in military forces and also the CIA beginning to arm the Peshmerga in northern Iraq?
I believe that the U.S. is being dragged back into Iraq, but with very limited parameters. The administration is trying to be very strategic and limit the involvement so that it won't come any way close to U.S. involvement there until a couple of years ago. But the U.S. administration is likely to find that it will have to expand its involvement in Iraq beyond what it originally planned. But so far, when you just look at the events of the past weekend, this is the most limited kind of intervention possible. But the U.S. will have to go for a lot more than that.
Oh, and when you say a lot more expand, I mean, that the president has been very clear so far, saying he will not send in U.S. troops. The troops are the boots on the ground idea. Are you saying that that's could be in our future?
I don't think that's going to be in our future, even if for the simple reason that it became such a symbol for the president that there is no way that he can authorize something like that. But the U.S. can cause lots of damage using its air power, and the U.S. Can send special forces that are usually just not counted as boots on the ground because we don't really know about their existence. The U.S. will send advisors and intelligence, but you will not see U.S. forces taking the lead in the fighting. The U.S. will try to direct from intelligence centers and coordinate with Kurdish and Iraqi forces. but the symbolism of boots on the ground is just too much to swallow for this administration. So I don't expect us to see that.
And I think we're still trying to make connection with Brendan O'Leary. Would you say, though, Barak Mendelsohn, that the Kurds, and this would be the Peshmerga, the fighters in the Kurdish part of northern Iraq, that they need the U.S. military to help them fight or perhaps even defeat ISIS?
They absolutely need the U.S., but they need the U.S. mostly for intelligence, for military equipment, and for bombing from the skies. They can be extremely effective. This is not very different than what the U.S. has gone through in Afghanistan in 2001, where most of the activity, there were very small forces on ground forces. Most of the activity was done by the Northern Alliance with bombing from above and intelligence that came to direct the forces on the ground that were mostly Northern Alliance, as I said. So the Peshmerga can be the foot soldiers, the boots on the ground that the U.S. need, but they just need a real support. They need intelligence, they need weapons, and they need the aerial cover.
I'm still, and I think a lot of people are just still scratching their head how this group ISIS, and I don't know if we should call them ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State. I've seen a number of references to them, but nonetheless, how they have been able to defeat the Iraqi military, how they've been able to take over parts of Iraq and also parts of Syria. It seems like it's maybe 10 or 15,000 people. How should we understand how they have been so successful?
Well, for one, apparently they have very smart military strategists. They've been planning the attack on Mosul for a couple of years. They were very slowly, they made their advances, demoralizing people in the area, making sure that nobody can rise against them, establishing roots on the ground, taking control over neighborhoods in Mosul for over a long period of time, bombing campaign, assassination campaign. The lightning attack in June was just the culmination of that step. So they were extremely effective and ruthless to the point that they had such motivation and managed to create such fear effect that increased the fear of the other side, the Iraqi forces that were just unable to match that zeal and were poorly equipped, poorly trained. The damage that was done to the Iraqi military in the last few years under Maliki was extremely, this is an extreme decline in their abilities, and they never got the real support, especially the forces in the north never got the support that they needed from the central regime in Iraq. But now we learn that the Iraqi forces are actually weak everywhere. We first thought that it was mostly the northern units that are weak, but the damage of the Maliki years mean that there is no significant force to stand in the way of the Islamic State. And so with their abilities, and of course, as they made progress, they captured weapons, and success breeds success that led to an even greater number of volunteers. And that's how they were able to build on their success to move forward and to make further acquisitions.
And apparently they are quite wealthy, that they have a lot of money.
They do have a lot of money. Most of the money, at this point, this is a group that is self-financing. There could have been significant efforts made in the past to stop them, because at first they relied on money from donors from Gulf states, but gradually they built their own financial machinery, and now they rely on funding from racketeering rings. They rely on money from selling oil that they now have plenty. One of the interesting elements in their military campaign is how they made sure to capture oil fields and water dams everywhere, both in Iraq and in Syria. And this way they have resources that they can both provide for their people and that they can sell to other people. So it's interesting to see how in Syria the Islamic State is selling oil to the Syrian regime.
Do they have how much support do they have among the public? And we hear from the Yazidis, they were told either convert to our form of Islam or leave or die. Is that how they exert control over the population?
You need to divide between the way that they look at their main constituency, which is the Sunni Iraqis, and how they treat the minorities, Christians and Yazidis. Now, according to their view of Islam, when it comes to minorities, only Ahl al-Kitab, which means primarily Christian and Jews, can remain under the control of the Islamic State and still exercise their religious rituals. But they are limited, and they have to pay a special tax in order to be able to live under the control of the Islamic State. Yazidis are not considered part of that; those people of the book, the other monotheistic religion that are supposed to be tolerated. And therefore, the Yazidis were faced with the option of either convert or die, which meant for most of them to just escape, run away. But the real constituency for the Islamic State is, of course, the Sunni population of Iraq. Now, even for the Sunni population, I think that the Islamic State is extremely brutal. They do try to do some hearts and minds, but they mostly gain the support of the people. I wouldn't even say the support of the compliance of the people, using force and using coercion. This is not a Sunni movement that has lots of popular support.
Well, we need to take a very short break. I want to reintroduce you, and after the break, we're going to get Brendan O'Leary in on our conversation. We are talking about Iraq, what is going on in Iraq, both militarily and politically, and also the humanitarian crisis in the northern part of Iraq, where a group of Yazidis are stuck on a mountain in northern Iraq. The U.S. and others have been dropping off relief for those people, but nonetheless, the situation is very serious. Talking with Barak Mendelson, Associate Professor of Political Science at Haverford College, we are going to take a very short break, and fingers crossed, hoping to get Brendan O'Leary in on the conversation. He's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Stay with us. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think should be done with to at Iraq?
Open Sky Energy, a solar energy company, supports WHYY. Open Sky Energy helps homeowners and businesses explore whether solar is the right investment in a relaxed and informative way. More at openskyenergy.net.
Hi, I'm Stephen Quinn. Writer Roxane Gay joins me to talk about her new essay collection called Bad Feminist and why she thinks modern feminists should steer clear of seeking perfection. That's coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm. the latest healthcare developments,
how what happens in Washington affects you,
how world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about the crisis in Iraq, what it tells us about American foreign policy there, the future of the region. And again, I've been talking with Barak Mendelson, associate professor of political science at Haverford College, author of a book called Combating Jihadism. And Brendan O'Leary is in Galway, Ireland, and we're hoping to connect with him via Skype. He's a law professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Program in Ethnic Conflict. He has been an advisor to the Kurdistan Regional Government in Iraq and wrote a book, including one called How to Get Out of Iraq with Integrity. And Brendan O'Leary, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Very good. Okay, that was a big pause there coming from me, and I'm happy to have you part of our conversation. I want to just go over a couple of things that I was talking with Barak Mendelson about, the fact that there are now U.S., apparently 130 U.S. military advisors in northern Iraq. They're being called assessors, so I guess assess the situation there. Also, the CIA is apparently now arming Kurdish military forces to take on ISIS, as we've been talking about how ISIS has been able to gain a foothold both in Iraq and also in Syria. What do you want, as someone who has worked with the Kurdish government, what do you want the United States to do?
I think it's not necessary for there to be any deployment of U.S. troops to support the Peshmerga. What the Peshmerga require fundamentally is equipment and sufficient ammunition. In the past, the U.S. has not supported the proper arming of the Peshmerga because it has been overcommitted to supporting the federal government in Baghdad. If Washington is wise, it will realize that the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government, is its only stable democratic ally in the region, and it will encourage both France, the United Kingdom, as well as other allies to supply the Peshmerga. They were taken by surprise by ISIS in recent days, but I don't think there's any fundamental problem about the Peshmerga's capabilities.
When you talk about supplying, so you're talking about really arming the Peshmerga without U.S. air support, for instance?
U.S. air support will be necessary in the short run, but I don't think it's a fundamental requirement for the long term. Indeed, there's no fundamental reason why the Kurds can't be given their own air support systems and indeed their own air force. The Iraqi constitution grants to each region the right to provide its own regional security. In my view, there's no constitutional obstacle to Kurdistan itself having its own air force, provided it's compliant with the general policy of preserving a federal Iraq.
And how do you think, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but you know, there's so much concern about these refugees, Yazidis, who are stranded on this mountaintop. How do you suggest or even think they can get to safety without being attacked by ISIS?
I have visited many of the Yazidi and Christian villages which are currently being subjected to ISIS's brutal attacks. I have profound sympathies, obviously, for the persons there. I don't have the local sense of exactly what's happening in Sinjar, but in my view, what's required is a repeat of what happened in 1991 when a safe corridor was created for the Kurds. And I think that would require military cooperation by Britain, France, and America, together with Peshmerga forces on the ground. And I think what's required is to create some safe channel to get those people down from the mountain and into Kurdistan for safety. And then what's required from the international community is support for the humanitarian crisis, which Kurdistan is currently bearing the brunt of. And it's doing so in circumstances in which Mr. Maliki cut off Kurdistan's budgetary requirements and entitlements. So there's a short-term problem with the Kurdistan government's funding, which can be settled in the long term, I think, both as a result of the immediate negotiations that are underway in Baghdad and for the longer run.
And I do want to talk about the political situation there. But to you, Brendan O'Leary, and then to you, Barak Mendelson, do you think ISIS can be defeated or just sort of driven out of the Kurdistan part of Iraq? I'll put that to you. Yeah, Brendan, go ahead.
I think that ISIS can certainly be defeated within Kurdistan, both Kurdistan as it was before June the 10th and Kurdistan as it's expanded into the areas which historically have been Kurdish majority. I think it's also further possible to defeat ISIS in the rest of Iraq, but that requires a political agreement in Baghdad for a transformation of Baghdad's policy, both towards Kurds and towards Sunni Arabs. The number of personnel involved in ISIS is relatively small. They have access to significant weaponry, and they're currently reliant on the extent of alienation of the Sunni Arab population from Baghdad. All of that is reversible, and it will take time, but it is reversible.
Do you think, Barak Mendelson, that ISIS has overreached?
I don't think that ISIS has overreached. It seems like it's a win-win situation for them, at least the most recent drive north. Yes, they might be driven out of the Kurdish areas. I think that this is a very likely scenario if the Kurds get real support. But they do manage to show that they are a significant actor. They are fighting now on about 3, 4, 5 different fronts. The ability to do that, the ability to move forces from one location to the other according to their needs. We hear today about the advances that they're making in Syria. This is a real military force. And so from their perspective, this is a situation where they can continue to surprise the world and take very smart strategic moves. True, they are taking significant risk. Getting the U.S. more involved could mean military setbacks. At the same time, it will also entrench the sense that Muslims are under attack and will help them to dominate the jihadi scene. They can build on that as a way to generate more support for the Islamic State. And it seems actually that they were really believing that the U.S., if it will intervene, will be so reluctant. So that doesn't seem like it was a very a very difficult gamble for them to make. If the U.S. is not intervening in a serious way, they can make inroads into Kurdish territory and to show themselves as an even more serious force and to show the to allies of the U.S., the U.S. cannot be trusted. ISIS is looking at Jordan as well, and Jordan is very anxious. And when the Kurds can't get enough support from the U.S., then it strengthens the position of ISIS in other fronts as they're planning to advance on Jordan. I think that there's considerations here were not unreasonable. They might suffer some setbacks, but I don't think that they can be eliminated anytime soon, definitely not with the resources that the international community is willing to put into the fight against ISIS. They can only be driven out of the Kurdish area. A lot more will be needed in order to actually defeat them, and a lot more that means also taking measures inside Syria. I want to just highlight that.
Sure, go ahead.
We're speaking about the difficulties with the Kurds and what an inclusive government in Iraq might do to bring together the Shiites and the Kurds. But the idea that would be enough to reverse the tide in the Sunni areas, I think that this is a lot more, a much more contested claim. Things that could have worked a year ago are unlikely to work now. Yes, ISIS is not building or doesn't generate enough public support among the Sunnis, there will be a lot of people that, if they could, they would rise against ISIS. But in order to do that now, that ISIS has control over so much territory in the Sunni areas, I just can't see the scenario in which you can credibly commit to convince Sunnis to turn against ISIS. The fear factor is so strong. The historical the history of the Sahwa, the Awakening Councils, shows Sunnis that they cannot trust the Shiite government, they cannot really trust the U.S., that there is no point for them to get any kind of promises and stand up against ISIS, only to see that eventually they're going to be dropped.
Well, picking up on that and going back to you, Brendan O'Leary, and I'm not even suggesting this, but when you see the ISIS fighters in open trucks driving on streets and very much out in the open, it does raise questions about drone strikes that the United States has been so willing to do in other parts of the world. I mean, if the United States were to directly take on ISIS, do you think they could be defeated?
Yes, I do think they could be defeated. I don't share Barak's pessimism. In the immediate period before the events of June the 10th, many Sunni Arab governors, many Sunni Arab politicians were trying to switch their political status from being provinces in Iraq to being regions like Kurdistan, which would have given them their own security and would have meant that they were not subject to the predations or discrimination of federal security forces dominated by Shiite Arabs. So the political project of what is required to stabilize the Sunni parts of Iraq is very clear. It's the implementation of the Constitution of 2005 or the remaking of Iraq as a confederation in which the Sunni Arabs will both govern themselves and police themselves. Provided that that is the political bargain reached in Baghdad, I see no reason why ISIS's recent gains can't be reversed. Moreover, there's a factor that has been omitted from conversation so far, although I didn't hear what Barak had to say at the beginning of your show, unfortunately, and that is Turkey, which is the major regional power in the area. As well as the United States, Turkey and Iran, these countries have no interest in seeing the success of ISIS. And they will. The government of Turkey regards the Kurdistan regional government as its reliable ally in the region, with which it has developed major commercial as well as ideological and political ties. So I have no doubt that the government of Turkey will be very keen on ensuring that both a reconstituted government in Baghdad and a revivified government in Erbil with American support will jointly be able to wipe back the gains made by ISIS. I'm not going to predict timetables. It may well take a long time, but it is plausible.
Brendan, to you, from what I read about the Kurdistan regional government or the Kurdish part of Iraq, that seems to be one of the few places in the Middle East where the United States has allies. Is that true?
It's absolutely true. American soldiers used to go there on vacation when there was an American presence in Iraq. Not a single American troop, to my knowledge, was ever killed in the Kurdistan region. The Kurds were the sole Iraqis to supply significant numbers to assist in the removal of Saddam from power in 2003. Kurdistan has definitely been America's major ally. But it's important to realize that there have been tensions between Kurdistan and the American government. If the Kurds had listened to the American government, they would not have had any Peshmerga. They would have dissolved them into an integrated Iraqi federal army. And if they had listened to the Americans, they would have had no constitutional oil rights of their own. In other words, America sacrificed Kurdistan's preferences for a deeply federal Iraq for America's preferences for a strongly re-centralized Iraq. And that is what is now over as a political project. The idea that you can reconstitute Iraq as a deeply centralized entity, whether for the sake of its own peoples or to balance against Iran, that's a zombie idea which must disappear from the mindset of American policymakers. What's required now is to make a comprehensive settlement among the three constituent peoples of Iraq, that each will be able to have their own security, police themselves and govern themselves, and jointly share responsibilities for the oil fields that were exploited before 2005. Otherwise, they should develop themselves as independently as possible. That's a feasible agenda. It's one that suits the interests of many significant regional powers, and I think it's also one that significant numbers of Shia politicians are willing to see materialize.
Do you agree with that, Barak Mendelson?
I think that this is absolutely right, that any solution that tries to recreate a centralized Iraq is bound to fail. A confederation has a better chance, and I'm not sure that the idea of three independent states is necessarily much worse than what we are seeing now. But all these ideas that we are raising come down to the notion that, yes, there are lots of actors that have interest in confronting ISIS, and that international cooperation, if it was based only on interest, should have materialized. Actually, should have materialized already. Should have materialized a long time ago. That means that there is still something that is missing. And perhaps the biggest thing is a real willingness by the U.S. to get its hands dirty. And so far, until the end of last week, we saw very little indications of that. And even now, I'm not really convinced that this administration has made that mental switch to understand that this is a real crisis, and the only way to solve it is by a U.S.-led international cooperation. But the U.S. has to lead, and has to lead from the front this time. Otherwise, all these great ideas will just not help.
But picking up on that, I mean, if that were to happen, Barak Mendelson, that would be the third time that the United States has sent a military into Iraq in about, 20 years since the first President Bush?
Iraq is a difficult place, and sometimes the U.S. made Iraq an even more difficult place. The fact that it's the third time, I don't think that this is necessarily should be a big issue. This is where you now have the problem. Just because the U.S. intervened there before doesn't mean that the U.S. should not intervene again. And as I said earlier, we're not speaking about boots on the ground. There are enough forces on the ground that can do the fighting on the ground. But the U.S. has to be a lot more involved than it is. If in 2006, when the U.S. Allied with the Sunni Muslims to basically repress the Islamic State of Iraq, the former incarnation of the Islamic State, at that point, it was much easier for the U.S. to get support from the Sunnis, create alliances, and let them do most of the fighting. I think that today the situation is going to be different. The U.S. will first need to show real commitment and take real action in the Sunni areas if it wants to really reverse the tide there and get some Sunni actors to then support it and do the rest of the fighting on the ground.
And I do want to pick up on that. Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a break here. And I do want to talk about some of the political issues related to what's going on in Iraq. And again, that's Barak Mendelson. Also with us, Brendan O'Leary. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents Old Crow Medicine Show, Jason Isbell, Janice Ian, Loudon Wainwright III, Natalie McMaster, Tempest, The Lone Bellow, Tommy Emmanuel, Sarah Jaroche, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, it's the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 14th through the 17th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Weissman, who covers Congress for the New York Times.
This is a Congress that really is doing nothing.
Weissman says by all measurements, laws passed, days in session, issues dealt with, this sharply divided Congress is the least productive in history. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Going backwards in Iraq with blinders on.
At this point, I think there's a reluctance even to want to know, both among the public and in the administration. It's just too much of a nightmare to be dragged back into this country, and yet that's what's happening.
Writer George Packer on Baghdad's shrinking influence and an Iraqi future that looks more like Bosnia's violent past. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It does feel like deja vu all over again. We are talking about the military, political, and humanitarian crisis or crises in Iraq, talking with Brendan O'Leary. And he's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Program on Ethnic Conflict. Also with us, Barak Mendelson, associate professor of political science at Haverford College, also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is here in Philadelphia. And I think we just lost Brendan O'Leary, so we'll try to reconnect with him. I will go back to you, Barak Mendelson. And this isn't necessarily to point fingers, but nonetheless, how much do you think the U.S.-led war and then occupation in Iraq led to the problems that we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times? How much is it the fault of Maliki and how he basically ran the country and divided so many of the people along sectarian lines?
It's impossible to replay history, so assigning responsibility is going to be hard. Of course, the U.S. came into Iraq, broke the country that was a bad country, but relatively stable, and then didn't manage to put it back together well. When it made some progress, it ended up leaving and having Maliki continuing the work, and instead of actually trying to create an inclusive Iraq, he immediately reversed the gains that the U.S. managed to make after the horrible mistakes that the U.S. made at first. So I think that both actors have some blame. But we need to entertain the idea of what could have happened had we didn't have the U.S. intervention and without Maliki. Just around the Arab Spring, how would the Arab Spring would have played in Iraq? And it's possible that we would have seen Iraq falling apart anyway. It has all those ingredients for that kind of collapse. And it might have been that the Arab Spring would have sent Iraq into a civil war, even with Saddam still in power. Definitely the events in Syria would have been, the fact that in Syria you have civil war would have had negative effects on security in Iraq. So there are many ways in which jihadis could have established themselves in Iraq, in many ways trying to figure out the blame. Probably not going to be very helpful.
Let me get Brendan O'Leary back into the conversation. And I do want to talk about the political situation. Iraq apparently has a new president. He has chosen a new prime minister, replacing Nouri al-Maliki. It looks like, at least as of today, Maliki is reluctant to give up power. What do you propose, assuming this new government can be formed, what do you propose, Brendan O'Leary, to address the insecurities in the country, the violence that seems to happen almost every day, and of course some of the political infighting as well?
There is no magic formula, but the new prime minister designate, he's not yet prime minister, that requires an affirmative vote by the Iraqi parliament. He has 30 days to form a cabinet. It will be vital that cabinet be not only inclusive but structured so that it will work in a collegial way, that the forms of despotic power exercised by Maliki over the defense forces and the security forces will no longer be evident. It will be essential that the new Shia-led prime minister restructure his interpretation of Iraq's constitution to be compliant with the constitution of 2005. That means for the Kurds ensuring that they have their oil rights, their production rights, including their export rights, fully protected. They have their budgetary cuts, which were unlawful, fully restored to them. It will require also that appropriate and genuine commitments are given to the Sunni Arabs. This will require, in addition to the possibility of Sunni Arabs being able to create their own region along the lines of Kurdistan, or several regions along the lines of Kurdistan if that's what they want, credible commitments in the area of reforming the security forces. That's going to be difficult, but it can be done.
Do you think it will be done?
I think it's possible that it will be done. I think you can expect that Kurdistan will demand what will be, in effect, the equivalent of a treaty, a series of commitments to be given by the Baghdad government, timetable commitments regarding both security, the way in which the issue of the so-called disputed territories will be handled, and the issues regarding oil. In these respects, I think the United States could be incredibly helpful. For the last 5 or 6 years, minimally, the United States has supported the federal government of Iraq and not the Kurdistan regional government on the question of its oil rights. If the United States made it clear that along with the government of Turkey, it saw that the Constitution does allow the Kurdistan region to produce and to export its own oil, that would significantly underpin a commitment to a genuinely federal and decentralized Iraq. And that would indicate also very strongly to the Baghdad government that American policy had changed, that it isn't simply going to prop up whoever is in power in Baghdad.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We are talking once again about Iraq. Serious things happening within the country, a number of political, military, and humanitarian challenges. Let me get Jack, who's been very patient, joining us from Haddonfield. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Thank you. When we first entered Iraq, I remember thinking that if we just got rid of Saddam Hussein, all would be well in Iraq again. And I think we made it worse. And now I'm falling into the trap that if we just get rid of ISIS, all will be well in Iraq again. And it doesn't seem that's true. Are there any Sunni leaders there who would be willing to work with the Shiites, and are there any Shiite leaders who are willing to work with the Sunnis?
Jack, let me toss that to Barak Mendelson and see what he has to say. Thanks for the call to Radio Times.
It's going to be harder now. I think that there is a willingness by among some Sunni leaders to have better relations with the Shiite government. But at this point, this is very risky for any Sunni politician to stand against the Islamic State. They need to get a lot more commitment, credible commitment, from external actors and from the Shiite government to take that kind of risk, since they're under the control of the Islamic State. Most of those politicians will have to be probably located around Baghdad or outside of the country rather than in territories under ISIS control. And then there is the question of, let's assume that they manage to work together. What does that mean when you need to translate that to Sunni action on the ground? That's why I'm becoming a lot more skeptical. Absolutely, there are Sunnis that would love to see the recreation of Iraq, but they have such little belief in the Iraqi government. This is not just about Maliki. They just lost their trust in the Shiite government in Baghdad, and I don't see how you can reverse those very deep beliefs that seem to be borne by reality. This is going to be extremely difficult.
To you, Brendan O'Leary, are there Sunni leaders that have condemned the brutality of ISIS?
Many of them, including the governor of Mosul, Nujafi, who is a brother of the Sunni, former Sunni speaker of the Iraqi parliament. Ayad Alawi is an important figure with Sunni support, who's Shiite in origin. There are many Sunnis who would like to achieve something in between dominance by the federal government of Iraq, which is now dominated by Shiites, and ruled by ISIS. And the smart ones among them, even before the events of June the 10th, were seeking to establish their own regions to have put in place the processes which were permitted under Iraq's constitution to establish their own regions. And Maliki's government did everything illegal and everything improper to try and block that possibility. So for many Sunnis, that will be a key issue for negotiations with a government being formed by al-Abadi.
Brendan O'Leary, there's an article I read in the New York Times. I cannot get it out of my head. I'll just read a couple of lines. This is Peter Baker. The headline, for two U.S. presidents, Iraqi leader proved a source of frustration. And he writes, one day in the fall of 2007, President George W. Bush joined Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in a video conference to sign a declaration of principles on the future of the Iraqi-American relations. As Mr. Bush scrawled his name, Mr. Maliki in Baghdad just passed his pen over his copy, pretending to sign. At the last minute, Mr. Maliki had decided not to sign because he said he had not read the document's final wording, but he did not mention this to Mr. Bush, who had no idea his counterpart's pen had not actually touched paper. And I cannot sort of get that out of my head. This was back in 2007. Why have we been so supportive of Maliki?
It's a very good question. I think it's simply because the U.S. has been on autopilot since about 1980. Independently of all the interventions in Iraq, the U.S. has believed that it needs a strong government and a strong man in Baghdad to balance against Iran and to hold Iraq together. It's the U.S.'s lack of belief in the possibility of a pluralist federation in which people would have very extensive self-government that has been an intellectual blockage to America supporting multiple politicians committed to a federal Iraq rather than investing in a particular strongman. So it's vital now that U.S. policy doesn't shift all its resources from being invested in Maliki to being invested in al-Abadi. It's vital that the U.S. Support, not with boots on the ground, mm-hmm. the Kurdistan Regional Government, which is a functioning entity, and do its best to accomplish similar forms of Sunni self-government. That's the way to tackle ISIS, not with direct military intervention on the ground and not with the project of seeking to re-centralize Iraq.
Let me get Stephen from Hamilton, New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm just calling. I just have a question, I guess, or a comment.
Sure.
I know after World War One, they kind of divvied up the Middle East and made those countries. Maybe it's time for them to figure out how they want to settle themselves.
The idea is let Iraq.
That makes sense.
Let me make sure I understand your question, Stephen. The idea that these countries, in a sense, solve their own problems themselves.
Yeah, but they were actually formed by Western powers after World War One, so they just kind of threw everybody together instead of just letting them figure out how they wanted to live themselves.
Well, Barack Mendelson, we can't roll back the clock.
But I'm just saying, like now, maybe now it's time. 100 years later, maybe it's time for them to. Figure out how they want to conduct themselves, I guess.
Well, let's see what Barack Mendelson has to say. Go ahead.
I'll be glad if the people of the Middle East will have a much more significant voice in actually redesigning their region. But we cannot assume that they will do that in a democratic way. So I doubt that you will actually have a reflection of the will of the people. What you're going to have is radical armed groups that are using violence in order to reshape the Middle East.
And maybe this is what you can say, maybe this is what the region wants and needs. And that would be legitimate. But then the question is whether the U.S. can actually accept this kind of new map of the Middle East, whether the U.S. If the U.S. is willing to completely walk away from the Middle East and come back in 10, 20 years once the Middle East figured out how to restructure itself, maybe that is fine. But since the U.S. still has interest in the Middle East, since the U.S. cannot afford to see such horrendous pictures like the Yazidis escaping, and there is a real humanitarian concern and humanitarian interest of the West in the Middle East, I think that the idea that let the people in the region determine for themselves is nice and honorable, but is not going to work.
Well, and
the West should not try to impose its position.
And I'm sorry to interrupt there. Only can we have a minute, and I want to put a question to you, Brendan O'Leary, as someone who's been an advisor to the Kurdistan regional government. Do they want their own country?
They do. All Kurds want their own country. They don't regard Iraq as a nation. They are willing to make Iraq work as a multinational state. They do not think the constitutional obligations of 2005 were honored or met. Some think that they should try and remake the constitution of 2005. Others want to go for confederation. The majority would like to have independence. But those who want independence know that at the moment it's highly unlikely that they'd get widespread recognition, and that it's vital before they get they pursue the project of independence that they establish the security of Kurdistan as a sovereign state, that they establish its territory, the security of its army, and its ability to survive economically. All of those things can be accomplished. If other Iraqis, namely Arab Iraqis, want to keep Kurdistan as a partner, then they have to recognize its national status and its sovereignty, and then there's some prospect that Iraq may survive.
Well, Brendan O'Leary, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Time. Sorry about some of the technical problems that we had having you up, but thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And welcome. I'm Hint, and again, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, Barak Mendelson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And he's associate professor of political science at Haverford College and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can send us an email, find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.